a star of immense magnitude.
The part of his statement that I was concerned with was that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus.
Give the letters which thou findest about me to Edmund, Earl of Dorset.
Welcome to Revolution 2
through 8.
And this is episode 1 of a new podcast covering anything tangentially connected to the Beatles.
And there's a lot of it.
There is a lot of it. My name is Zach, and the other voice is...
I'm Dylan. Hello.
We are Beatles fans, and we were inspired when we watched a YouTube video like a few years ago now called by Todd in the Shadows that talked about a Ringo album to explore the solo work, because before a few years ago, I don't think either of us really explored any of the Beatles solo work.
I don't think so. No. Certainly we were aware of the big hits that John, Paul, and George had put out as solo careers. And to some extent, you know, I was familiar with like some of the stuff Lennon did with Harry Nilsson in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're both, you know, huge fans of The Girl Is Mine, the Michael Jackson duet. But, you know, beyond some of those high points, we're kind of like, I don't know, Beatles normies. We've listened to, I think, all of their sort of, you know, albums and like past masters, like all their singles. But beyond that, not really.
That's true. So we want to take this as an opportunity to share with others anything connected to the Beatles. As we stated earlier, we will cover some of the Beatles films, actually probably all the Beatles films. The goal is, once we go after every avenue that's connected to the Beatles, this podcast will end. I don't know when that will happen, but there is an end.
The Beatles cinematic, musematic universe is still being created to this day.
It's true. Ringo did release a new album recently and is touring. I think it's this country music album. So we decided to start is with my very first album that I ever got that was mine, which is Beatles 1, which was released in 2000. So what's on 1? Can you tell us what's on 1?
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that. The title and the album art really give it away. This is all of the number one hits that the Beatles had. Citation needed. They were looking at like the Billboard Hot 100, which is the primary singles chart here in the United States. And then they looked at one of the British charts. One thing that I kind of forgot about when you go back this far into like music, because everything, of course, was tracked by magazine and like trade papers, there were a lot more charts, like little itty bitty outfits, like tracking these numbers back then than we have today. Like now it's basically just Billboard, but there was also like Cashbox, and like Britain had like, you know, three or four different charts. It was kind of a wacky time. So if it reached number one, it made it on the album. There's a couple of songs that did reach number one, but because it wasn't on the Billboard chart or because it wasn't on the British chart that they were concerned with, maybe it was on a different British chart or maybe it went to number one in a different country, those sorts of things are not included. So there are some songs that I think of as being really big, or maybe I just really like them, that are absent. Mm-hmm. But we've still got like nearly 30 songs, so it's a good selection.
Yeah, so everything you just said is wrong, because in researching this, I discovered a Reddit post that said this is actually a secret concept album that the Beatles have been building towards.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm sending this to you right now. So this album is about teenage love, going through like the end of your, basically through your adult life. There's like stories of somebody this guy is in love in the first few songs. Then we get to Ticket to Ride and he breaks up with the person he's dating. And then he gets back together with her and We Can Work It Out. And then from some reason he joins the Navy because of Yellow Submarine. He also writes books. And then he gets nostalgic for back where he's from in Penny Lane. Then they break it up. And they have a kid, and they use the breakup song for as Hello Goodbye. It's the breakup song. And then he also names his child Jude, but then they get back together at the very end of it. But that's the concept album.
I agree with the comments here. I need whatever drugs this man is on or woman.
We're not going to dox this person because that's
they also deleted their profile. So they, I don't know, maybe they were getting doxxed, or maybe like Paul was like, how'd you figure it out? I need to join my crew.
And I think what he's noticing here is that the songwriting of the Beatles gets progressively better as they go on, and they also mature about what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to sound like they're progressing because they were. So what we're going to do, we're not going to cover all the songs on here because we are going to cover normal Beatles albums in the future. We don't want to like kind of cut into those. So there's some where there's like, I think both of us have two songs, maybe three. You have three. I have two. So five. So we have, both of us have 10 songs. Five of them are from an album and we're going to kind of go through them and we'll take some looks at some of the other songs. And we have a few little things to say. There's just some songs we don't have a lot to say, like Love Me Do. It's just a good little song. I don't know if you have much to say about Love Me Do.
Harmonicas are cool.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to go through this album now. I don't know how you feel about some of the songs you chose.
You know, for some of them, I actually don't have a tremendous amount to say, but they might be personal or I might have an anecdote to share. And that's really why I think, I guess, we maybe chose this album. It's kind of a good touch point, right? A lot of people can remember their sort of first experience with the Beatles. You know, it's kind of interesting to explore it from that lens and then just sort of what some of these songs might mean to us or just what we really like about them.
Okay, so we're going to start off with Dylan's first song.
So I'm going to start us off here. The first track that I want to look at is I Want to Hold Your Hand. This track was the first Beatles song to go to number one in the United States. It's the fourth track in the album, but the other songs charted at number one earlier over in the UK. I was kind of surprised at sort of how late Beatlemania and the British invasion got started over here once I actually started to look into it. I guess for some reason, I just thought that one day there were no Beatles and then it was Beatles everywhere. And that's not really true, but not in the way that I thought. What year do you suppose I Want to Hold Your Hand made it to the charts?
It's either 63 or 64.
Yeah, it was early 64.
Mm-hmm. That's when they got on the Ed Sullivan Show. It's like February, I think probably probably early January. I had to write a paper on this in college. Yeah.
Gotcha. So maybe you're more educated on this than me, but this was all kind of new to me. So from what I gleaned, one of the news outlets wrote a little happy fluff piece about this British band that's really big in Britain, and they were going to air it one evening. Well, unfortunately, the evening they chose was November 22nd, 1963. For those not too keen on their history, that's the night Kennedy died. So there were other things, more important things to talk about. But they still had this piece shot and filmed. So later on, I think in December, they're like, yeah, we need to fill some time on the air, roll the fluff piece. And then people are like, oh, I like this. And they call their radio stations like, where's the Beatles? The Walter Cronkite or whoever was just talking about the Beatles. Where are the Beatles? And then we had Beatles. So what I did to kind of touch on this, I asked my grandparents when they first heard about the Beatles, if they could remember. And my grandpa, you know, he said he was more of a Stones guy than a Beatles guy. But he's like, well, they had hits, so I'm sure I heard them on the radio. I'm like, okay, that's fair. My grandma said, well, you know, I remember I went to my friend Joyce's house. And she's like, you gotta hear, there's this new band, they're British. And she wasn't really into them. Like, all of her friends were, but she didn't really care for them that much. But if you want to be cool, you gotta like the Beatles. So, you know, she bought this record, and she remembers seeing them on Ed Sullivan. And that really surprised me. I always pegged my grandmother as a bigger Beatles fan, but no, she was, like, more old school. She really liked Ricky Nelson, if you know who that is.
No.
He was, he was your typical teen idol of the day. One thing that stood out to me when I listened to this song, probably for the first time in several years, which is true for a lot of these songs. I haven't like been actively listening to the Beatles in a very long time. These early songs are surprisingly rough in both their lyrical content and like their execution and production. I don't know. Did you get any sense of that?
So last week when I first gave this a listen, I kind of thought that quite a bit.
So some examples that I noticed of like weaker writing in like the early Beatles is like there's like a really weak rhyme in She Loves You. There's like, I think it's the apologize to her line doesn't really like rhyme. Like, not that things have to rhyme, but I don't know, when there's not a lot going on to the song anyway, you kind of tend to notice. What I noticed with I Want to...
Interruption?
Yes.
So my favorite part about She Loves You is that at the very end of All You Need Is Love, they reference She Loves You. And that's my favorite part of She Loves You, where she's like, she loves you, yeah. That I love that part. That's like one of my favorite parts of All You Need Is Love. They were thinking about the love experience all the way back when they made Magical Mystery Tour.
They already knew. They were building the musematic universe of the Beatles. In I Want to Hold Your Hand, what I noticed was a lot of instances where John and Paul, you know, they're singing harmony or they're singing together. Mm-hmm. And like one of them kind of forgets the words. Like there's the bit where they kind of change the lyrics up a little bit and they're like, you'll let me hold your hand. But when I think one of them comes in with is going to sing, I want to hold your hand. And the other one's singing, you'll. And you hear that mistake. And you hear that a couple of different times in the song, which, you know, studio time's expensive. Sometimes you just got to choose the best take and run with it, especially when you're a fairly new band as they were. But yeah, I found it really interesting that, you know, those flaws are still apparent there.
I will counter and say that a lot of Beatles, even this early stuff, is very functional. Like everything kind of works for me. I actually think like the Lennon McCarthy connection is already kind of set. We're just gonna grow from here. Like the parts where I get high, where you hear Paul in that part. I really like that part of the song.
Yeah, no, none of what I say is to like say that it's a bad song. There aren't any songs on this that I hate. I do have like one or two candidates for least favorite, but you know, it's all enjoyable to listen to. The other thing that I'll just briefly mention before we move on to other songs is that there's this idea that I've heard from a number of people, and I've probably read it online as well, that between Elvis kind of dropping out of the charts when he was, I think he was doing military stuff, like that time between Elvis and the British invasion, when the Beatles started to get popular, is kind of this weird miasma, this weird like dark period in music that like nobody wants to talk about or acknowledge. They speak of it as though there was like nothing good to listen to, which I have my doubts about, because like that's when Motown Records was getting started. So like there's got to be some good stuff there, but it's interesting that that's the perception.
So moving on, there's two songs I kind of want to do quick little things. Can't Buy Me Love. I've never been a big fan of this song. It's fun from a interesting that point of view, where a lot of the songs we'll hear a little bit later talk about monetary exchanges and of love. that this is the one where it's like, no, I won't give you gifts because love. Also, I don't know if I misinterpreted or I've heard somebody say that they thought the lyrics of the song were cat puppy love.
That wasn't me, but that is excellent.
Isn't it?
That's so good. No, for me, this was the first like really clean song on the album. Mm-hmm. That where like the production felt like it had tightened up a fair bit.
So my first song is I Feel Fine. And I remember listening to this one a lot because I love the weird audio feedback that is on the beginning of this song. And apparently, but at this point, like The Who and the Rolling Stones had been using the audio feedback in live shows. But this is one of the first instances of it being recorded on a record before. And that sound that you hear at the beginning is Paul doing something on his bass. And I love it. It's really dopey. I don't know. Like, I don't think a lot of songs do it that way, or that boom, wah, type of sound. But I think this song is really fun. It is a little weird lyrically, as a lot of John songs are. There's very strange, like, moving in and out and of, like, perspectives. Because there's at one point when I was listening to this where I'm like, is the woman in this song, like, dating somebody else? Because, like, if you listen to some of the lyrics of this song, it's like, baby says she's mine. You know, she's happy all the time. You know, she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. And then you get a little bit later, he says, yeah, that her baby buys her things. You know, who is he, John? Who is he buys her diamond rings? Who is he? That's something I was really obsessed with. Like, who is he? Also, for Rubber Soul fans, I always get uncomfortable hearing John say little girl, because if...
You better run for your life.
Little girl, if she with another man. We may have another song that has very similar energy to that I'll talk about a little bit later. The groove of this song, I think, is absolutely excellent. It just moves you through. One thing we didn't state in the last song, Paul and Ringo just power through. Like, their bass and drum connection is excellent. Like, they just always make this very functional and move us along of boom, boom, boom. I don't know. I think this song is absolutely excellent, really good. And part of me just got really confused about the perspective changes, because I know we're getting to the point when they started doing the doobies and the marijuana and probably start hanging out with Bob Dylan. Do you have anything to say about I Feel Fine?
The one thing I'd like to add upon that you shared was kind of about Paul's functional, very functional and tight bass lines. On my feed, a video came up from a channel I'll give proper credit to here. It's called Luke from Become a Bassist. That's the name of the channel. Mm-hmm. And he goes over a lot of the different bass lines that Paul performed during his time in the Beatles. And what he determined, his take, is that the bass lines were always functional, but for a good while they were either boring or they were straight up, like, lifted from other songs. But once they started touring in the United States, you got some more interesting and inspired bass lines. Again, kind of going back to, there was a lot of Motown on the radio, and apparently Paul drew a lot of inspiration from that. And so that's where you got some of those more sliding, kind of more interesting bass lines, rather than just, like, you know, copying what the lead guitar is doing, or, like, just going, like, up a fifth or whatever. It's interesting. I'm not much of a music theory guy, but it's interesting.
We are both not.
No, mm-hmm. No. What's your background?
I played violin, so I'm kind of used to that really big sound at times.
Sure. And for myself, I was trained on piano, and I can kind of mess around on piano these days, but, you know, it's kind of use it or lose it. Otherwise, I have kind of a choral background. I did do some jazz choir. I did do some musical theater. But yeah, as far as, like, composing or playing compositions, mm-hmm. not a lot of experience with that.
Well, and with that, I think this next song, which you're going to cover, is probably one of the best songs on this whole album, and maybe one of their best early songs.
So we're talking 8 days a week. The little personal connection I'd like to share about 8 days a week, and I asked my entire family, and none of us could really remember why we landed on it, but my uncle got married some years back, and somebody thought it would be a really cute idea if we were to kind of, as a family, maybe sing a little song to the couple. I think it was known at that time that at sort of the like rehearsal dinner, like afterwards there was going to be like karaoke. And so my grandparents were like, we need to practice this. And so I trained my grandparents, who are my uncle's parents. I trained my mother, my sister, and myself. And we all kind of learned the song. It was really difficult for me to train them to do the clapping after the hold me, love me, Like that was incomprehensible to these people, my family, who I love dearly. You know, I'm trying to teach these people from the deep heartland with no sense of rhythm. It just kind of broke them. We practiced it enough that we made a good, valiant effort. It was cheesy and cute and adorable. That's my personal connection to this song. Now, as far as the song goes, I just think it's very pretty.
Yeah. I think this also is really telling that this is the first song that is on this album. One of my big issues I have with this album is that there's actually a lot of good songs that we were talking about, that Dylan was talking about earlier, that
yes,
we're surprised were not number ones. That I am like just really surprised that these are the ones that were number one. But 8 Days a Week is the first one on this that actually starts with like an instrumental part that is immaculately, mm-hmm, immaculately produced.
That fade in.
Like that bum 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 bum.
No, I love it.
Oh, it's so good. But yeah, 8 Days a Week is, I think, just a perfect little song. I really love it. It is excellent. Just the stupid lyrical spin. This is where you can tell they actually have like an interesting sense of humor of 8 Days a Week. I know it sounds really silly to like, well, that's so genius, but it is. There's not 8 days in a week. There's only 7 days in a week. So it's like you're doing it all the time, as they say in the song. And it's great.
No, I think I read somewhere that 8 days a week might have been a Ringoism, been one of the off-the-cuff things that he said, but...
Okay. I mean, Ringo is the genius of this band.
He's a golden god.
We know that. We are very excited to talk about Ringo, who does not have many songs. He is a god. So we're going to go to my song that broke my brain, because I really thought about this song a lot. We're now in the Help era. We're talking about Ticket to Ride. I think this is, once again, an immaculate composition, just very pretty. The instrumental part of this is weird, but the lyrical part of the song is fascinating. I don't know if you looked into the lyrical part of this song at all.
I haven't read the lyrics, but I listened to the song. What stood out as odd to you?
So there's just this latent violence in this song that fascinates me, and like latent kind of weird vibes that John gives off, where, you know, she's got a ticket to ride and she don't care, but it's like, why does she have a ticket to ride? And, you know, she said that living with me is bringing her down. Yeah, she would never be free when I was around.
I mean, this is kind of part of that larger conversation about, you know, some of the songs that John, you know, is the primary writer on regarding women are kind of odd. They're a little weird.
They are.
They're a little sus.
But no, the other part of this is interesting, is that she had to think twice. She had to do right by me. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, I always thought this was like a love song. Also, apparently, I did some little research. The ticket to ride is implication that it's a prostitute.
Oh, okay. Interesting. It's a bit of a stretch, but I guess you could take some poetic license with that.
I think it's like a phrase in Germany. I think that's kind of what I was reading. Because this is like about their time in Germany. Beatles are a lot more crass than you think they are.
Yeah.
If you listen to them, I mean, very crass. They have a...
I mean, they're just kids. I mean, they're so young. The thing that stood out to me most about this song, and this is just kind of A, dumb, and B, I wonder if it's just like an age thing for me, because I'm finding this with a lot of songs, is mm-hmm, I remember the tempo being significantly faster, like enough to where when I listened to it for the first time, I was like, oh, this song is dragging. This feels really slow. I think it's a me problem.
I think it is a you problem, because I actually, before we did like one of our listeners for one of the artists, I actually probably would listen to the Beatles albums at least once a year. So the most recent I've listened to all of the albums was like 3 years ago.
Okay.
So I'm quite familiar with the song, because I really love Help. Yeah. No, I think the tempo is just right. I get what you're saying. I think listening to the first ones, I was surprised by how brief they were, where they're like much quicker than I remember. Like even like Love Me Do, I Want to Hold Your Hand, it's just like, just kind of hits you. It's like, whoa. And now, and I think this is kind of the problem with the structure of this album, is that once we transition to these sexy songs, we start getting much slower, and there's a lot more busy aspects to how composition is, because there's more instrumental bits, there is a lot more thought, and yeah, you can just tell this is produced much better. Any other thoughts about Ticket to Ride?
I don't know that I'm going to have a place to mention it otherwise, so I'll just mention it here. You know, we try to make something of a to-do about you know, on this one, album tracks versus single tracks. Tracks that you would find on the album versus what you might find on past masters. Now, with the widespread re-releases, like say in 2009, of the original Beatles discography, that's made pretty straightforward. Kind of at this point accepted the British discography as the canon worldwide. And, you know, the fact that back in the 60s, Capitol Records did some funky wacky stuff with the track listing for Beatles records, even if they shared the same name as the British album, it was kind of a weird thing. From what I've been able to gather, there was sort of an expectation at the time that your album needed to include your big single at the time. So like there still were plenty of instances where you would have a popular single and it might only be available as a single and not on the album. But that was a lot more prevalent in, as I understand it, the UK versus in the US. They're like, no one's going to buy your record, your album, unless it's got your hit song on it. So slap that on the record.
And like Rubber Soul has a pretty, I think like Rubber Soul has like, I've Just Seen a Face on it.
Yes. The American version of Rubber Soul does.
No, I'm happy you brought that up. No, it's really strange. Like I did a few years ago because I was going to go see Rolling Stones and I didn't. No, I actually did go see the Rolling Stones, but I did this, I listened to all the Rolling Stones records, and up until you get to like the late 60s, it is so confusing about what album to listen to, even Apple Music. Like some of their, because like since you get a lot of the ones on Apple Music I listened to were the UK's stuff, so you didn't get a lot of singles at all, and it was kind of surprising. Now that you bring it up, it is surprising that a lot of that came out, even that was even a thing, even going through with the New Order song that came, Blue Monday, which is one of the best selling singles in UK history. That was not included on the album. That was just purely a single, and that would have made Power Corruption Lies like even more of a classic if that would have made it on there. But it's very interesting not having your big hit single on the album, which makes sense. Like some of the songs on here, I don't think would have made sense on the album.
Just out of curiosity, with the Stones, I take it that was a single only, Satisfaction. Like that wasn't on any of the.
That was not on.
That's so weird because that's like, you know, one of their top five most iconic songs.
Yeah. It's weird. Moving on from that. Let me see. Who is the next person?
It's the Tripper.
Day Tripper. I actually have a connection because I listened to this back in the day. I did not think this song was about drugs. I thought it was about tripping, like literally tripping.
Like over your shoelaces?
Yeah, that's what they thought this song was about. You're like, what about the rest of the lyrics? And I'm like, yeah, one night stands. It's like, yeah, she's one night stand because she fell.
I guess, you know, I took it as the more intended wordplay, like a day tripper being somebody who maybe takes a day trip somewhere. Sure, why not?
That's a good take, too.
Obviously, words can only mean one thing, and you shouldn't look for hidden meanings.
So we're going to go to your next song.
Okay, so I picked We Can Work It Out as something I kind of wanted to chat about. And it's not a song that I'm like super deeply familiar with. Like I've listened to most of the songs on this album more than I've listened to this one. But in the context of this album, I found it really interesting. It felt like the clearest shift in sound to me of them kind of being sort of your classic kind of rock and roll, kind of inspired by like Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry, you know, kind of your just an evolution of a 50s band to more of a kind of studio band that they would eventually be known for.
Question for you.
Yeah.
What instrument is most importantly added that we're going to hear a lot throughout the rest of the discography? That is the first time you've ever heard this on this album.
So I thought it was an accordion, but it isn't. It's like a pump organ. It's like a little itty bitty small church organ.
Really? I thought they had added it. I thought it was the harpsichord.
In We Can Work It Out? No. When it goes into 3-3 time, when it kind of feels like a waltz, that
do, 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 do. That's an organ, really?
Yes. I thought it was a musette or like a small accordion, but no, it...
We're going to hear that sound a lot.
The Beatles are going to have their haunted carnival phase, and they are going to milk it for all it's worth.
They are. Because we'll get that all the way to Abbey Road, because has that, right?
Oh gosh, I haven't listened to Because in a while. Because I think is more of like an electric, I don't know if it's even electric, but like a harpsichord or like a clavichord kind of deal. That one I don't think is an organ.
But it has like the same Haunted Carnival aspect still.
Yeah, like maybe not carnival specifically, but like haunted, like Victorian child vibes.
Keep going about the shift in the sound.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much it. It feels like a clear shift because we get these new instruments that we weren't getting before. We're changing up time signatures mid song, which that in a rock and roll song you don't see, not back then. And I guess you could argue that this one maybe isn't rock. It's probably more pop. You know, those lines get really blurred as the Beatles kind of evolve their sound, and then they get into artsy avant-garde stuff. But yeah, this is where they really start to step away from that, you know, something clearly rooted in like older style of music, and it kind of becomes something new.
So what's also really interesting about this song is that this is in a sense a Paul song.
Yes.
But it also is a John song, where they're two different things, really. They're not, where it just feels, we'll kind of hear something like this like within a day in a life, where they will sometimes come up with ideas that just kind of force two different ideas into one song.
I was reading a little bit and I consulted the Paul McCartney Bible, the title of which.
Oh, the lyrics.
Yeah, the lyrics.
Lyrics. We'll call it Gideon's Bible from now on because of our love of Rocky Raccoon.
Rocky Raccoon's fantastic. I referenced Gideon's Bible on this one. And so it's about Paul kind of and his spats he was having with his girlfriend at the time, Jane Asher. And George had the idea to change it to that waltz 3-3-4 time. I think I said 3-3 earlier. I meant 3-4. Because it would kind of make it feel more disjointed. Like it would make it feel like there was some friction going on. And I read somewhere else, and I don't have a source for it, but in a lot of ways it was like one of the last like really good collaborative moments between John and Paul, where they kind of wrote a song together. From this point on, songs are a lot more clearly Paul songs or John songs. I mean, they'll still help each other, but the difference is becoming clearer in that.
Yeah, and I think this song also shows the growth of Paul in some ways that we haven't really even heard a lot at this point, because for me, at least what's on here, early Beatles stuff is very John dominated. If we look at all of what's on here, and later Beatles, I feel Paul really grows into himself and kind of learns how to function much better, and maybe to the detriment of the vibes in the group. But I really like the song. It's actually one of my favorite songs from this album. I listened to the song quite a bit when I was a kid.
Yeah, I like it a lot more than I, now that I've listened to it a couple of times, than I did previously. I was surprised by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bridge is really interesting. Yeah, I love it. Thank you for choosing this one and going into the detail about this one.
But now we have to put this aside, and we have to talk about, I wonder, would you say that this next song is the most recognizable Beatles song?
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is probably, when I was a kid, probably my favorite song.
I think most kids are introduced to this one. We're talking Yellow Submarine. So the one personal story I can tell you about Yellow Submarine is going back to that discussion I had with my grandparents. I asked if my grandma saw like A Hard Day's Night or Help or any of that. And she's like, no, not really, which kind of surprised me. What surprised me more is that my grandpa chimed in and he said, yes, like, you saw a Beatles movie? He's like, yes. And it was Christmas Day. Him and his roommate went to go see Yellow Submarine.
Weird.
my grandfather is you know, not exactly a hippie. You know, he's pretty straight laced. So that really surprised me. What didn't surprise me is that he said it was the worst film he's ever seen. I have seen all the. Have I seen? Yes, I've seen all the Beatles films. Right? Because there's like four or five. There's Hard Day's Night. There's Help. There's Magical Mystery Tour, I guess. TV special, movie. Mm-hmm. Whatever. And there's Yellow Submarine, and then there's Let It Be, and then now there's like Get Back, which I haven't seen yet because I'm a fake fan.
And the 64 one that came out like recently too.
Oh yeah, yeah. Haven't seen that either.
I haven't seen a lot of the Beatles movies. I've seen the latter two, though.
Have you seen Yellow Submarine?
I've never sat through it.
Okay.
I think.
So first thing you need to know about that film is that even though it stars the Beatles, I think you've probably known this, don't provide their own voices to the film. They got voice actors to do that mm-hmm. for them. They, you know, it's all animated. Basically, the Beatles show up in live action for like a little cameo in the end credits, and that's it. And as I recall, this caused a bit of a spat with the studios. I think they had like a contract saying they were supposed to make four movies, and that someone tried to argue, this doesn't count. You weren't in it. Like, make us another one. And that's kind of why they had to make Let It Be. That's what I remember reading from many, many years ago.
An underrated aspect of that movie is the soundtrack that George Martin composes. It's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. The score is beautiful.
But let's actually talk about the song.
I suppose. Yeah. The song came out quite a while before the movie did.
I love everything about this song. This is probably, when I was a kid, one of my favorite Beatles songs. I think Ringo in this, like the bit towards the very end of this song was like, in all yellow, where he's doing weird backgrounds like sounds where he's kind of just it's really good. I really love Ringo on this song. Everything about the song is great. The weird imagery, which I kind of love how weird this is, of how, because you kind of get wrapped up in what is this submarine,
is the submarine drugs too, is it all drugs?
No, this, I think this is like about fame and money.
Can't it just be about someone who enjoys submersibles on the weekend?
I wish they were like, there's a fun Spanish version of this that we'll probably eventually listen to when we listen to Yellow Submarine, because there is a soccer team called Villarreal that plays in Spain.
Okay.
Their uniform is in yellow, and in like 67, 68, somebody behind one of the goalposts just played Yellow Submarine, and that eventually became their nickname. So their nickname is Yellow Submarine.
That's fantastic.
It is. But Yellow Submarine is interesting. It's just a song that it's so nonsensical, which is really down Ringo's wheelhouse. Also, for people that want to know a Ringo song that should have been on this, Act Naturally, even though that's a cover song.
Yeah. So let's take this opportunity to steer the conversation in a direction I want to steer it.
Okay.
So all of the songs on here are Beatles originals, which is totally fine. You know, that's good that most of their success was with, you know, original compositions, you know, Lennon, McCartney. You know, we got one Harrison track on there.
Yeah.
But they had some darn good covers. And I was really surprised that Twist and Shout wasn't on here. Like, that, to me, for the early Beatles especially, one of the most iconic tracks. And maybe that's only in hindsight. Like, you know, it's been used in, like, mm-hmm. movies. Like, you know, there's that Ferris Bueller thing.
Ferris Bueller, yeah.
So, like, maybe we only grew to really love it and appreciate it after the fact. But I would have bet money that that was a number one hit.
Till There Was You, I think that's like Sar. Like I swoon for Paul saying I Sar.
I never Sar them winging.
So good. I never Sar them at all. Till There Was You. I love Money. So one of the things you may have heard at the beginning of this is one of the covers of Money, since Money is being covered by Flying Lizards. We are committed to trying to listen to every cover of Money eventually.
And they'll all be better than the Beatles, because I don't care for their cover of that song. I want to talk about one more thing while we're here. This version of One that we're listening to is the 2015 version.
I do think the Yellow Submarine mix on this is inferior to other mixes of Yellow Submarine. I do not like this mix.
How so?
It's just quieter in places that I don't like.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's valid. There are a couple of tracks that we discussed earlier. There are some tracks on here of the earlier Beatles song where I feel like there's a lot more echo or reverb on the vocals that I'm used to seeing. Now, that might also be because when I purchased the 2009 remasters on vinyl, I mostly bought the mono mixes, and the echo and reverb was a lot more common on the stereo mixes, so that almost certainly colors my perspective a little bit. Let's move on.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about Penny Lane, because I was kind of looking for a song that I like, and this is a song I haven't listened to in a really long time, but I really, really like this song. There is some really fun flourishes. I'm a sucker for describing a place, and that is what the vibe of the song is. I do like the trilogy of Beatles songs that I can can think of off the top of my head of Back in the USSR, Ballad of John and Yoko, and Penny Lane, of just talking about location. And I think this song brings you somewhere. You can tell it's a little bit more trippy. It's a very surreal song. They're one of the best parts of the song, I feel, is these in-between parts where it goes from Paul's vocals to John's vocals, where it's like one of the examples, like in summer, meanwhile back, and it just goes from Paul to just John doing that, and then it kind of goes away. I really like that fade in.
It paints a beautiful picture. I didn't care for this song initially when I first got into the Beatles, and you know, I would consider myself kind of a late bloomer to the Beatles. Like, I got into them, I guess, around the time of the 2009 remasters, basically.
One bit fascinates me of how I mishear lyrics. As we brought up earlier, I mishear lyrics. There's a part where it says, "In the pocket is a portrait of the Queen." I thought it said, "In the pocket is a portrait of a queen." I did not. It took me many years until, like, I realized, oh, it's talking about Queen Elizabeth II. Boo. It's more interesting when it's a random queen to me for some reason. I have to kind of like trick my brain into remembering, oh yeah, he's saying in the pocket is the portrait of the queen and not a queen.
That's excellent. My favorite part of Penny Lane is the French horn solo.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. And I don't remember what track it ends up in. In Love, the remix album, they put it somewhere else and it works super well there as well. Like whenever I hear Penny Lane and I hear that solo, like my brain just like goes back to Love for whatever reason.
Oh, okay. Because this comes up with Ballad of John and Yoko. I'm like, what? Cause the other thing that weirded me out on this lyrically is that there's a part where it says, "The banker never wears a Mac in a pouring rain." I always thought he said, "And that banker man wears a mask in the pouring rain." Very strange. So a Mac is a raincoat. I realized this. I looked this up just now.
That must be some hyper-specific...
It's a British slang.
Scouser slang or something.
Because I noticed that in the Ballad of John and Yoko. I'm like, what is a Mac?
We're both Return of the Mac.
But yeah, like I think this is a lot of the writing that we'll kind of hear a lot more. Like this song, even though it's kind of going to be a Magical Mystery Tour and probably written during Sgt. Pepper, kind of reminds me of a lot of the songs that kind of sucked me in for like White Album. Like there's a lot of vibes of like White Album just like absorbs you into the weirdness of what the song is about. And Penny Lane, and I'm pretty I don't know, just a really good song. It reminds me also of the Bob Dylan song, Desolation Road, which is one of my favorite Bob Dylan song. And yeah, any other things to say?
No, this is a song that tells a story, it paints a picture, and this would become like a strength of theirs throughout their later years here.
Oh my gosh, yes, I agree. And moving on from that, Lady Madonna. How familiar are you with Lady Madonna?
I like this.
Since you're not a past Masters guy.
I'm more of a Mono Masters guy. I like Lady Madonna a fair bit. I think it's well understood that Paul was kind of going for a Fats Domino thing, which I don't know how familiar you are with Fats Domino, but he was like...
I'm not.
He was a piano player, kind of like, you know, contemporary, maybe even a little earlier than like Little Richard, kind of like a piano rock and roller. He had a really big song, Blueberry Hill, in the like early 50s. I really like Fats Domino is all I'm trying to say with that.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul obviously did too. So like this bouncy piano is like kind of an homage to that. It's so effective, so much so that Domino eventually covered this song.
Nice.
And I listened to that cover a lot more than I listened to the Beatles version as of late. The Beatles version is fantastic. They're both good.
I'll have to listen to that version. I never knew that. So this is also our first example of Paul having weird voices at times. And he really has a fun voice on this song. Lady.
And he had done that a fair bit in like in some of the earlier Beatles tracks that, you know, weren't number ones. Some of the singles, like, you know, I'm Down, I think is one where he really goes at it.
Yeah. How can you not when I know I'm down?
I'm really down.
I'm down. Oh, that song should have been on here. That song's excellent.
Mr. Moonlight, he really goes ham as well.
I think every instrumental bit of this is excellent. Like the guitar part of that, which just sounds like the saxophone parts that come in, is just great. And then this weird because they're heavily inspired by Super Mario 64 of the
that reminds me of something else. What is it? No, you know what? It doesn't sound like Mario 64 to me. It sounds like Crash Bandicoot.
Oh, okay, okay. But no, I like this is just lyrically the song is kind of pretty funny. You have like children at your feet. I don't know. It paints a weird fit. Really, I'm here for the vibe. I like the vibe of the song a lot.
It's such a good vibe.
This is just a very fun song to just listen through. Like, it's Paul. I don't think about what he says as much as I think about John.
Grizzly, funny, deep voiced Paul is my favorite Paul.
He's really fun that way. Yeah, and the piano part in this is just excellent, as we already said. Saxophone parts are great. It's just a good song that builds on top of each other. So yeah, Lay Me Down is great. I love it. Don't have much else to say about it.
No. Check out the Fats Domino version. It's good. I mean, it's a pretty straight cover, but it's good.
So the next song we're talking about, I have a friend that's a jerk who, for some reason, doesn't like this song, from what I recall. But we're talking about, I think, probably one of the best songs of this whole album, The Ballad of John and Yoko. I really like this song. It's really good. This song was banned in many places. You couldn't play it in Spain because John was making a political statement, and this feels totally like John, a man who is going to go on to make a song called Woman is the N-Word of the World, where he said we're going to get married in Gibraltar near Spain. That made Franco, the dictator of Spain, upset, because that was a very tenuous thing about who owns it. Does England own it or does Spain own it? And that did not do it. And when he says, Christ, you know it ain't easy, he's calling back to that bit earlier. Oh, where he says, bitch, ring the Jesus, and he's like, crucify me. So this could not be played in Chicago in most places because of that bit, because it was just too offensive. And I think it's a really fun journey. And this is the, from what I researched, the last true, like, Paul and John song that they recorded together, and they did everything. It's only them. It is that those are the only two people that are on this. No Ringo, no George. So all the drum bits you're hearing is Paul. And I think the bass on this song is fire. It's very fun. The jangly guitar is really good. I don't know why anybody could dislike this song. As a lot of things, it's just a fun journey. Paul and John are really fun when they just write about going to places. How do you feel about this song?
I have thoughts. All right. So I don't hate this song as much as I thought I did.
You hate this song?
It's not my favorite. That's not the same as hating. It's in my bottom five on this album, probably. So you say it's one of your favorites. I will point out the Spotify metrics disagree with that heavily. It is the least played song on this album by...
I didn't know Spotify had metrics. We on Apple Music do not get that.
Oh, they do. On desktop, they do. So the most, yeah, so the most played song.
Wait, can I guess?
Yeah,
can I
go
guess?
For it.
Is it something?
No.
Okay, let me guess again. Is it Come Together?
It's Come Together. So yeah, Come Together, per Spotify at time of recording, has 843 million plays. Ballad of John and Yoko, 57 million.
It's still a lot. But my take of this is that people don't realize this is fun John. This is the John I like. Like, we will not... I'm going to argue that we're not going to get a good John song like this for like 4 or 5 years.
I agree with you on that.
And this is a hot take because we haven't listened to any of the solo stuff. Like, Paul and John complete each other, but Paul, I think, is better at papering over the fact that he doesn't have a John.
John takes a while to in my and our estimation, kind of find his feet as a solo artist.
Kind of surprised me how much I liked listening to it, because it's just a jam, and I really like the flow of this song quite a bit. And I think I gained more respect of it because of what we eventually are going to have to cover. Like, those first three albums, excluding the live one, they're something, which is the song we're talking about next.
So we're talking about the one and only George Harrison composition on here. You know, George usually had about roughly one song per album. Mm-hmm. He had I think one album where he didn't have a song, but then he had the White Album where he had a handful of songs, so I guess it kind of evens out. The main thing that I think about something is not the recording, but I and you were fortunate enough to see the Cirque du Soleil show.
Yeah, the Cirque du Soleil stuff is really cool with this song.
It was a, you know, sort of a, basically the whole Cirque du Soleil thing with the Love album that was on, that was performed in Las Vegas for 15 years, something like that.
Yeah, closed down, last performance was last year.
It had a good run. And like, the whole thing is basically, interpretive dance, right? They mm-hmm. plumb the music through the speakers, and you're kind of watching these people, you know, move and you know have set pieces, you know, to the music. The two people kind of dancing during something was probably the bit that stuck out to me the most.
Oh yeah,
that I remember the best.
Agreed. I think this song just is so emotionally vulnerable. I not only think this is one of the best Beatles songs, but I think this is probably one of the best love songs ever recorded. I adore, really, just for us, a very slow, the middle part of the song where you're asking me where my love grows. I don't know. And if you stick around, it may show. I don't know. It's just great. And what Ringo's doing on the drums right there, like, it's just really interesting. I love this song. This is, jokingly, I do love Ballad John Yoko, but this is probably my favorite. It's not one that I listen to a lot on this re-listen, but it's a lot like Come Together that we were skipping. When I get to this, when I'm listening to Abbey Road, it's one of my favorite parts of Abbey Road.
It's definitely like the ultimate, like, slow jam, like the best Beatles slow jam that there is, like, bar none.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, during that middle portion where my love grows, like, the, you know, some of the tightest harmonies they've ever done, you know, it's from that era where they were just really on top of production.
And that's about all the songs we're gonna cover. We could have covered The Long Winding Road, but this podcast is getting a little long and winding.
Ha.
Is there any other thoughts about this concept album?
I'm not convinced it's a concept album. I'm pretty sure the year 2000 came around and they said, gee, we haven't done anything with these Beatles properties in a while. Want to make some money? Yes, I would like to make some money.
So with everything, thank you for listening. Where we go from here, we're going to cover everything that that encompasses the Beatles.
And not necessarily in order.
We'll see where this goes. So yeah, and that will be fun. We'll have a good time with it. Be some weird times. So we will be moving to Two Virgins next. It's an adventure. I don't know if this episode will be as long. It might be a short episode.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I mean, we had to restrain ourselves on this one because there's so much material. We'll find things to say about Two mm-hmm. Virgins, and you'll have to wait to hear those thoughts then.
And this has been Revolution 2
through 8.
And thanks so much. To order
the Beatles, thanks for hanging out.
On your screen.
Bye.
Or send $18.98 for CD or $11.98 for cassette, plus shipping and handling, to the address below. Call now.